This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another. Hello, everybody, and welcome to CDP's Practical for Your Practice. This is Corinne Lefkowitz, joined today by my co-host, Jenna Ermel. Jenna, how you doing?
I am always happy when I'm with you on a podcast, Corinne. It just is a mood lifter each and every time.
You know, the only reason I do this podcast is actually to get the compliment at the start of each episode.
You
it's kind of what I live for.
Over and over again.
Well, I'm happy to be here as well. We have one of our own friends and colleagues with us today to talk with us about working with suicide prevention with younger clients. And I'm excited to learn more about that today, but I understand you have something to share with us to start.
I do, Corinne. It's very exciting. We have
da-da-da,
listener question.
Woohoo! And
this is coming in, and it's so well-timed, I will say. Coming in from Sheila from Philadelphia. The question is...
Wait, we always have to say, hi, Sheila.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for writing in. Can evidence-based therapies be adapted for children, or are they mostly geared towards adults?
Great question.
No, great question, and timely, right?
Absolutely.
So the short answer, Sheila, is yes. And the wonderful thing is that many, many different EBPs have been adapted for children, and definitely while lots of this, especially the CBT therapies, were originally developed for adults, many researchers have adapted these so that they're really much more developmentally appropriate for young clients. And you know, I don't know, Corinne, if you had examples or thoughts you wanted to share on this.
Yeah, it's one of those areas that I'm not as familiar with, because as our listeners probably know, I work primarily with adults and have for a long time. But since I work a lot with trauma, I've become familiar over time with trauma-focused CBT, which is really kind of the treatment with the most research behind it for children and adolescents. And I've heard people doing great work with trauma-focused CBT.
And then our own Kelly Cressman is an author, actually, on PE therapy for adolescents with PTSD. And then there's like a DBTA, which is DBT for adolescents. And I actually started out as a child. I thought I wanted to go into children's work. And I would argue, if you can do good evidence-based protocols with kids, you can do anything. Like it really helps set you up for work with adults really well. And I really like doing some OCD treatments, you know, John March's work. And
I was also thinking Sheila might want to check out our episode from, I think it was last season, with Dr. Christine Heflin, who talked about Match ADTC, which is an evidence-based kind of almost transdiagnostic. I think she didn't quite label it as transdiagnostic, but a transdiagnostic treatment for kids as well that has a lot of evidence behind it. So yes, Sheila, yes.
And then another one we might talk about is like today's topic, which is CBT for suicide prevention. Can that be used with youth and adolescents?
Jenna, you are a professional, because that was an excellent segue into the content for today's episode. And I guess we should start by introducing our guest and welcoming Allison Hanna to the episode. Hi, Allison.
Hello, hello.
We are so excited to have you here.
I am so excited to be here. I am a long-term listener, first-time guest.
Yes.
So super excited to be here after hearing so many amazing colleagues and professionals share their experiences over the past couple of years.
So I think this is the first person who can say she's a longtime listener, first-time guest, but maybe we'll have many more moving forward. That'd be great.
Just the beginning.
Yep.
We're going to have a t-shirt made, Allison. It'll be shipped to you this week with longtime listener, first-time guest. You
can and on the back, it'll say number one fan.
Number right? one fan.
Yeah.
I will wear that. I will wear that.
P for P.
Well, Allison, could you start by introducing yourself to our listeners and telling them a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm actually one of the newer members of CDP. So I just started here in July of 2024. And so I'm still in that very first year of learning just so much and starting this great journey, collaborating with awesome colleagues. I primarily work with our STAR Behavioral Health Program. So I'm a military behavioral health social worker with that program's my official title. Mm-hmm. And so I just have this awesome privilege of training providers to work with our military connected community, you know, really in this effort to expand mental health care access with a specific emphasis for our National Guard community. And then most recently, before I joined CDP, I was with an active duty medical center, and I worked in the child and adolescent behavioral health section. So during that time, I got to see a lot of the military dependents, some adults, but mainly I worked with teenagers. And then the last couple of years I was there, I also worked as the embedded school-based therapist. So I worked in two elementary schools right on base. So that kindergarten through fifth grade became that primary age group that I worked with.
Wow.
And now I'm here at CDP.
I always love hearing these snapshots because I learn so much. I feel like CDP has gotten so big. And so it's lovely to sort of hear your trajectory there. Vast amount of experience with lots of different subpopulations of the population we really, really care about. So that is really interesting. So again, today we are going to talk about suicide prevention with youth, and specifically CBT for suicide prevention. And one quick question that we had was, does this version for kids have a different name? But more importantly, like, what is it? Who does it work for? And if you could maybe sort of give a thumbnail sketch of what some of the techniques or treatment components are, that would be great. So that was like five questions in one
question. Yes. First question, five parts. Yeah. Right. Go.
Yeah. So, you know, CBT is so interesting because there's so many modalities out there that really use all of those techniques. And so I will maybe admit a little ignorance. I haven't seen it called anything different from CBT for suicide prevention for what I'm going to be talking about today. But that for sure is not to say it doesn't have another name that I'm just not aware of. But I kind of became interested in this evidence-based protocol when I was working a lot more with the teenagers. And so I was primarily using a lot of DBT, but I started to see just more and more presentations of suicidal ideations as just that initial concern that somebody was bringing up. And so, you know, I came across a good study on CBT for suicide prevention with adolescents. And so Dr. Stanley and Dr. Brown, who've done so much in this field, they had a really good study that was my initial way that I kind of got my hands on this. And yeah, I just started to read a lot more and see how I could fit that in for that population. And mm-hmm. then as I started going and I started working more and more with elementary age school kiddos, I started to see this concern pop up a little bit more and more. And it wasn't something that I had seen so much initially when I started my career working with kids, but over the last couple of years, really an influx. And you know, I'm sure many of the listeners know that suicide is one of the leading causes for death for that age group. And I pulled up the most recent numbers, and it's number two for kids aged 10 through 14.
Gosh, that makes me so sad.
Yeah.
That makes me so sad to hear.
Yeah. And so working with those younger kiddos, my background, primarily I had been using CBT, but also I've been trained in trauma-focused CBT. And so when I started looking at how this protocol fit, it really had a lot of the same elements and interventions. And it was just really kind of switching my mindset of, you know, what I'm treating first. And then I also am a registered play therapist. So I have this this background in using a lot of these protocols, but putting them in a developmentally appropriate context for our kiddos. And so that's kind of, I started tailoring what I knew of CBT for suicide prevention towards this population.
I like that you just added play therapist into the mix. Like we didn't hear about that. And here you are just throwing another qualification into the mix. That's so interesting. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about what some of those actual techniques look like. What are they? Because for somebody like me, it's kind of brand new to me.
Sure. Yeah. And so when we start kind of looking at some of the different elements of CBT for suicide prevention, you know, of course, some of those big upfront things that you want to be doing are safety planning and that chain analysis. And so, you know, those are some pretty big words for little minds. So they're not going to be able to, you know, conceptualize what you mean. You know, heck, I know obviously a lot of adults have difficult with that, difficulty with that as well. But when it came to safety planning, and you know, earlier I had said, really, this was becoming the initial concern that I was seeing. So it wasn't so much kiddos presenting with other behavioral concerns, but I was getting referrals straight from primary care and the ER and some kids who are coming out of inpatient settings. And so this safety planning piece was upfront that really important intervention that we wanted to go over. And so I think when I started seeing some of the differences, one, just in how we present it. So when you look at a normal like safety planning worksheet that we go over with our adult patients, you know, sometimes it can look pretty clinical, pretty sterile, and that can be difficult for like a kid to look at and like connect with. It can kind of seem overwhelming. And so was lucky to find my hands on, I don't want to say a kid friendly, but like a safety planning worksheet that had all the same elements, but was just laid out in a much more approachable way. And so the terminology that was used was a little bit more helpful for that age demographic. And you know, as we know, safety planning is its own intervention in itself. And so as we were walking through it, you know, it's really taking time to do those coping strategies, whether, you know, internal or external, and really finding a way to connect with those kids. So, you know, not just talking about deep breathing, but you know, let's learn ways that we're going to do that deep breathing, you know, whether that's, you know, smelling the flower and blowing out the birthday candle. Or sometimes I would use bubbles so that kids could actually like practice taking that big, deep breath and then slowly releasing it. So I think that's kind of how I started incorporating a lot of those play techniques into CBT for suicide prevention. And then as we start going into like chain analysis, like that next really important piece, you know, for some, we're sitting there again with worksheets, right? With adults, we're often using worksheets. And for a kid, like one, you might have reading comprehension issues, or writing issues. So when we can really play it out, so we are really not just role playing, but it might be like I'm going over to the dollhouse I have in my playroom, and the kiddo can take out these figures and they can really walk through their day and walk through, you know, what led up to those thoughts, you know, what was going on, and they can do it in a way that makes sense for them, because, you know, we know that kids learn through play. So little things like that, where, you know, again, it's this really great evidence-based protocol, but it absolutely can be tailored down to these younger ages. And, you know, in fact, knowing the statistics on how many kids are, you know, starting to have these thoughts earlier and earlier, you know, I would argue that it absolutely needs to be tailored for our younger ones.
I really love hearing the specific examples of how you sort of took the elements, the principles, the, you know, what you're doing in CBT for suicide prevention, and, you know, creatively engaged with kids to be able to make it meaningful to them. And that's why I think I said, like, if you can do great therapy with kids, I think it helps you be a better adult provider, because I think we still need to do some of that as providers with adults. But as you're talking, I was curious to know, you know, obviously this is a challenging subject that can cause a lot of distress for parents. You know, kids come with parents. That's why I got out of the business of kids, because I really like the kids, but then I was like, oh, I still have to work with the adults. Well, and I'm wondering how, this is a slight divergence, but, you know, as you're sort of presenting, like, I'm going to be doing this CBT suicide prevention with your child, or here's the problem that's going on right now. How did that go as you're sort of involving the parent in this journey with the child that they're very concerned about, obviously, or somebody's concerned about them? You know, that's just a touchy thing sometimes, or it shouldn't be, but I think sometimes providers don't have a ton of experience in that regard. So what was your experience like there?
Yeah, it's such a great thing to reflect on, because absolutely, I think there's so many emotions that will come up for a parent in this situation, right? I mean, I'm a parent myself. I know both of you are parents. There's so many thoughts that the parent is having. And I think there's a lot of denial, like, you know, how could this be? And sometimes that they can, parents can have just that initial knee-jerk reaction to be kind of dismissive, I have felt, like, oh, you don't mean that. Or, you know, how would they even hear about this? And so I think there's a lot of those feelings that start coming up. But I think once you start working with that parent and doing a lot of the psychoeducation, which, you know, is also a really key piece of CBT for suicide prevention, I've found that parents are very hopeful, knowing that there is a protocol. Like, we're not just going to go sit in the therapy room for, you know, weeks on end or hours on end and not have a plan in place. I've found that it's really helpful for parents to know, you know, myself as a therapist, like, I have a plan, and the plan that we can work on together collaboratively has actually been really effective for lots of ages. And so, like, let's take this journey together, and let's do this together collaboratively. And your piece is so important in the treatment process. But I think once, again, you have kind of that piece of psychoeducation, it's really, really helpful for the parent.
Allison, I am so thrilled that you brought that up, because I'm thinking really big picture now from as what you're describing, this notion that having a protocol that has evidence behind it can actually be hope-inspiring, hope-instilling. For me, and I know Jenna can relate to this, and I don't know if you can as well. For me, one of the criticisms that I hear, or concerns that I hear a lot about EBPs, is that it's this cookbook approach, and it's so structured and regimented, and people are not going to be able to engage, and you're not meeting patients where they are. And the flip side, and of course, if you do any treatment poorly, that's going to be true. But if you do it well, there's a flip side, which is that you have a tested mechanism that works. And when things feel really hopeless and really overwhelming, you actually have a plan in place. And in this case, the parent can really feel more optimistic and hopeful about their kid's safety.
Yeah, absolutely. And, that's an element too of CBT for suicide prevention, right? Like instilling that hope. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important when we look at this intervention that, again, it's not just the child that's coming into therapy. Like this is something that you have to have buy-in from those caregivers. Everybody has to be a part of the plan and be on board for it to work. And so, I think it's really helpful to have that plan in place.
Now, I know from your from our conversations previously that you got to deliver this treatment in really unique settings. And for example, in a school setting, and that I'm sure came with some really unique benefits, some really unique positive qualities, but also some challenges. So I'll give you a two-part question, not like Jenna's five-part question, just a two-part question. Could you tell us a little bit about some of the benefits that go along with that kind of setting, as well as some of the challenges or obstacles that you faced?
Yeah, so it was a really unique situation to find myself in the schools. I was actually the first school-based therapist at that duty station. And so I kind of got to I don't want to say make it up as I went, but I kind of got to figure out what was going to work for me working with the school system. So, one of the challenges I think we see when we're treating children is that children are absolutely so reliant on their parent to get them into services, to get them to the clinic, to get them to the appointment. I know I prefaced this earlier by saying how important that parent's role is, but sometimes you often see those barriers of like, work schedules, or I don't have enough sick leave to get my kid out of school, or going to get them out of school and then bringing them to an appointment and then trying to bring them back. Like that's a half day of school that they've missed. And
which
so it was
the problem sometimes, right? Like networks compounds problems.
So it was really cool to be in the school system because one, I knew that every week I would get to see those kids no matter what, right? Mm-hmm. Like even if it wasn't the particular day or time that we normally met, I would still get to see them for a weekly appointment. And two, like when we think about how important like that social support is for kids and we look at that person and environment context, school is where they spend the most of their time. And a lot of the safe adults in a kid's life are going to be at school. And so you have this awesome opportunity to be working with and collaborating with teachers and school counselors and the administrative staff. And then you also have this really cool piece where you can do a lot of like in vivo with them because like I can be right in the classroom with you and we can practice these coping skills right here and now.
That's very cool. That is a very cool feature.
Yeah.
It makes so much sense. And, I'm a huge proponent of sort of integrated behavioral health care and primary care, like where people go get there, but it's such a like, no duh thing, right? Like the kids are there. You're also normalizing, like it's in school, right? This is a part of your whole student, kind of thing is where you're going to go to classes, but we're going to have this for you to grow this area of your life. And it just makes a ton of sense to do that. I know you're going to talk about some of the challenges, but like I'm sold, Allison. I think it's a cool idea. More schools should do this.
Good job, Allison. Good job.
And if I didn't already sell you on it, like using an EBP in the school, like kids need routine. Like we know that kids thrive when they have routine that provides that extra sense of safety. And so when you have a protocol and you do agenda setting, like they're just so used to that from like their classroom
Absolutely.
Setting. And so they can transition like in and out of an appointment and like back in the classroom. And it seems to just like click that, like, what an awesome opportunity. But again, like there's obviously challenges as well. And so that's where kind of that parent piece also became tricky, because if you're seeing the kid in a clinic, you know, I know for sure I have a parent there that I can, you know, touch base with for at least 5 minutes, you know, maybe have them in there for half the session, and really work on it together. Whereas I often found myself like really trying to chase down parents, and no fault of their own or anything like that, but it became really, really important for me, like right from the beginning, to really set the stage with these parents on like what was expected of their participation. Like, how can we make this happen? Again, back to that psychoeducation on how important their piece is in it. But also, you know, scheduling times to still check in with them. You know, sometimes having to email them like a worksheet just so they could see what the kid was working on, just in case that piece of paper didn't end up at home, or they wanted an explanation of like what their kiddo was working on. So I think that was definitely a challenge, kind of that double-edged sword that I saw as a school therapist.
Yeah, for sure. I know our listeners like always very much value sort of lived experiences, you know, real case examples. Did you have any good, you know, examples or stories you wanted to share in this work that you did, this really important work that you did?
Yeah. So lots of cool experiences with kiddos. One I always can think back to is this child that I was working with. They were third grade. So they were about 9 years old. They were actually introduced to me through the school. So the school did a fantastic job, because this child drew a picture during one of their classes that had some themes of death. And so the teacher saw it and just was concerned, rightfully so. And the teacher did the right thing, brought it to the school counselor's attention. They got the kid down there, talked with the principal. They did an initial just like screening and asked the important questions, right? Which sometimes we don't do with kids that young. And the child said that, yes, she was having thoughts of wanting to be dead and killing herself. And so they called me in. We got the parent down there. I was able to do a really comprehensive risk assessment right in the school, which was very different, because usually, like, if I wouldn't have been there, the school's protocol is to call an ambulance and get that kid to the ER, which can be pretty traumatic, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And so met with the parents, met with the child, definitely high risk, and the right thing to do was to get that child to a higher level of care. And so we did get them inpatient for a couple weeks. But as soon as I got discharged, I met with the family the day after, and we came up with a plan on how we were going to proceed in the school environment, and was able to see that child through the whole protocol, and had very, very positive results. And it was just really cool, because even afterward, like, you know, I still got to see her in the hallways. Like, I still got to check in and, you know, say hi, or, you know, see her in the lunchroom. And I think we don't always get that when we finish a level of care. And so that was a really unique thing. And I think it was just also helpful for her to know that if anything did come up that she didn't feel she could handle, like, I was in the school. And so I was another safe adult that like she could come to, who knew what had previously gone on. So I think it kind of took away some of that stigma of, you know, talking about mental health and, you know, suicidal ideations and things like that, that kids can be really scared to talk about.
The thing that's so striking about that story, and I love that story, is, and you know, we always talk about continuity of care, but I think what you just really talked about was continuity of connection, right? Like, you were able to connect on this side of inpatient care and probably, you know, ease that transition. And then you were there again, you know, on the other side of it, and stayed connected with this this child, you know, even when she integrated back into school fully and wasn't necessarily seeing you. And I think, again, for youth, having that connection to the school environment, to, like you keep saying, like safe adults in that school environment, the how powerful that is, that you're just sort of like this anchor that was there should she need to, or like, you know, touchstone, whatever one you want to use. But just that presence in the school, having gone through that, you know, journey with her, is that I really think that story is a fantastic example of why all schools should be doing this. Yeah.
I focus on a different part of that story, similar, but sort of how integrated everything is. And again, this kind of holistic view of school is not just where you go to learn about math or English. It's also where you go to learn about emotions, learn about health, learn how to stay safe, learn how to connect with adults who care about you, who are safe. And, you know, maybe it sounds a little bit corny, but I just love that has sort of been roped into the formal education process. Because at least when I was growing up, that was not how mental health was dealt with.
And you knew some other student, you know, was probably inspired by that whole thing too, you know, in a positive way, or again, kind of the norm. You're not normalizing that, you know, I'm not saying we're normalizing people are, you know, all feeling suicidal, but just sort of normalizing, hey, sometimes people hit bumps, and when they do, and when things are rough, adults in this school are there to help figure out what's the next step, what's the next plan, and see you through on the other side. And it's, you know, not as scary and all the things that it can be made out to be.
This topic is scary. This topic is hard. This work is hard. And so Allison, it brings us to our question of the season, our topic of the season, which feels once again relevant, which our listeners hopefully are familiar with, and you may be familiar with, our question of who's got your six. This notion that the work that many of us do, and you especially, having talked to you for the past half hour, this work that we do is really tough, and we can't do it alone. And we hopefully have support systems that allow us, that empower us to do this work and to stay healthy while we're doing it. And that might be a professional support, that might be a personal support, but essentially, hopefully we all have someone, at least one person, who has our six. We're hoping you will share with us who has your six. We'll ask you to not name any names in particular. That's the one rule that we have for this segment. But without identifying anybody by name, who do you think of when you think of who has your six?
Well, first off, my mom would be upset if I didn't
okay,
name my mom.
Fine. I'm just kidding. Fine.
Yeah, we love you, but Allison's mom. Shout out to Allison's mom.
Good Thank job, Allison's mom.
Yes.
Yeah. But no, I think absolutely being in this profession, and especially working with children, I think can be really, really tricky. And so when I was thinking about this, especially in my last position, when I found myself embedded at the school, like, of course, I had some fantastic staff members that I met there. But what I found helpful for myself was that the school day ended and I still had, you know, about an hour or so left of my work day to finish up notes and things like that. And so I was lucky enough that the clinic that I worked in was only like 5 minutes away. So I went back to the clinic every single day because I was around some really great colleagues there. And so whether I just needed to go sit down and vent with them for a couple minutes, or I needed to consult on something, like I needed to be in that like close proximity of them. And then especially one of my colleagues, we really clicked. And one important routine that we had was like, we got off of work every day at the same time. And for the most part, almost every day, we walked out to our cars together. And so that like Right. 5 to 10 minutes where we could just walk out. And I think boundaries is really hard, especially in mental health, but also working with kids and like leaving things at the office. But that like 5 minutes or 10 minutes where we just started talking about, oh, what are you making for dinner tonight? Or what do you got going on this weekend? Like that really helped in that transition and really helped in my self-care and just overall sustainment. So yeah, that was really helpful for me.
I love that example. And transition is the right word. Like really transitioning from that often very stressful work day to something that might be supportive, but also is just a bit more lighthearted to get you to the next phase of the day. I love that.
I do too. And I thinking back to very similar situations where there's something about like, okay, we're done talking about work now. What are you making for dinner? And it's a very conscientious thing. So that's great. Well, Allison, it has been fabulous chatting with you. We're not quite done yet, but you've given us a lot to think about. I'm sure a lot of providers have thoughts on, you know, interesting things that they can do. We also love to leave our listeners with what we call actionable intel. And these are things that they could sort of take forward in their practice and apply immediately or learn about right away. If we have folks out there who are interested in learning more about CBT for suicide prevention, and especially, you know, with kids and youth, and layer on top of that, so, you know, ways to integrate into a school system. Did you have any resources or thoughts or ideas for them?
Incoming actionable info.
Well, first, just kind of like how we've talked about earlier, like a lot of EBPs can be tailored to children. And so if folks just in general want to know more about CBT for suicide prevention, you know, shout out to CDP, who has a wonderful 2-day training program on that they can take. And then I'm also excited because our DoD child collaboration team has also recently, just in the past year, and I think one just really recently came out, where they've put 2 asynchronous trainings out about suicide risk with youth. So I'm sure we can link those, but
we will.
That was interesting because in my previous role, I actually did some trainings through CDP, took the MATCH training and was using that protocol. And in one of the consultation sessions afterward, like that was one of the big things that came up for me, was like, this is a really great protocol, but like, what are we doing to address like suicide risk? And the people we were meeting with were like, well, funny you should ask. We have some things in the work. And now I've been able to see some of those come to fruition. And so I've gone on and taken them, and they're fabulous trainings. And so definitely check out there. And then the 988 Suicide Crisis Lifeline website has a whole section for youth as well. So some really great resources out there to check out.
Oh, that's great. We will link them all in the show notes so that people can access them for sure. That's really helpful. I am really grateful, one, to have you as part of CDP as one of our newer members. You bring such a wealth of experience and knowledge and enthusiasm for the work that you do. It's been a pleasure to have you here, and I'm just overall excited to have you as part of CDP. Thank you so much for joining us today on our podcast episode.
Thank you so much for having me.
And remember, all of you listeners, stay curious
and mind your EBPs. See you next time.
Bye.
Remember, we love hearing from our listeners, so leave us a message on SpeakPipe or send us an email. Both can be found in our show notes. Our theme music is Failed Attempts by Nitro, and our administrative assistant is Bree Mercer.
Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
If you like what you're hearing, please feel free to follow us, rate this episode, and share it with others.
Until next time.